Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The day Markov was stabbed by poison, Markov and me, we were having a cup of tea. I can still remember how he said, Georgi said, I feel I'm getting fever and I'm getting weak. I don't feel well. I'll go home.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Svetlana came from a dissident Jewish family opposed to Soviet rule in Latvia. Her parents survived World War II, but during the Stalin era, two members of her family were held in the gulags. It was almost impossible to leave the Soviet Union. However, in 1971, the first opportunities for Jewish emigration appeared, and Svetlana, then aged 12, and her family left legally. At the age of 16, she's staying with her uncle in London, where she comes across Bush House, the home of the BBC Russian service. Svetlana manages to get a job there and begins to get promoted. She meets Georgi Markov, who is assassinated by Bulgarian security services on Waterloo Bridge in London. She's later introduced to Oleg, the chief editor of the Russian service of Radio Liberty, a CIA-financed station beaming Western propaganda into the Soviet Union. This meeting has a profound effect on her life. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Svetlana to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in a Jewish family. My father, my late father, and my mother, my late mother, they were both born shortly before Latvia was annexed by the Soviet Union. So as children, well, as youngsters, teenagers, they could still remember the free Latvia, and they were quite shocked for the rest of their lives, I think, with what happened to them. And especially interesting is the story of my father. His native language was German, a German like many Jews. He was Jewish, just like my mother. He was from a well-off Jewish family on the outskirts of Riga. Today, the city is called Liepāja, Liepāja in the old times. So anyhow, when the war started in 1941, according to the Soviet Union, I mean the Second World War, my father didn't know a word of Russian, but he and his friends, who were quite active in the Zionistic movement of Latvia, knew about the killing of the Jewish people. So he was wise, together with his friends. He just turned 19 or so. So maybe 20. So he was wise not to wait for in Riga for the Germans to come. They went towards the Red Army. When they ran into the Red Army, they didn't know a word of Russian. So it took them about 2 weeks to prove that they were not fascists. So they were lucky not to be killed by the Russians. In fact, there is a story that there were five of them, and one of the persons was killed because they couldn't get a translator soon enough.
Incredible. Incredible. Can you tell me what role your father had in the Red Army during World War II?
So eventually, when the Russians took my father into the army, he was a student of medicine, but not yet qualified. He didn't finish his studies. You know, some years ago, about a year ago, when Russia started publishing their archives, I found the card of my father there. And I was surprised to see that he went all through the war. He reached the rank of colonel. He was head of a medical unit. But because he was Jewish, he was not quite allowed to be in the forefront, so second line. Anyhow, he finished the war in the rank of colonel. After the Second World War, the German prisoners of war were slowly sent back to Germany. And my father couldn't leave the army after the end of the war because he was ordered to stay as a translator for the prisoners in the prisoner camp. And prisoners were slowly returned to Germany. My father was not released. It was during the Stalin's time. So just in case, I guess, to make sure that my father turned sides and stay as a German spy in USSR, he was put in Gulag. And it was 1953 when Stalin died, when my father was released. And the same fate happened to my uncle. We say in Russian, from bell to bell. He stayed for 15 years in Gulag because he told a joke about Stalin. So I'm a late child to my father because he was over 40 when I was born. And these stories that were told in the family, but really very in a very quiet manner. You can imagine what kind of atmosphere we had. Basically, all my relatives were victims of the Stalinist repressions.
It's hard to imagine living under that level of repression, but I appreciate you sharing that, Svetlana. Did you have any relatives in the West?
One of my mother's brothers in 1953, six, I think it was, when Jews of Polish descent were allowed to go to Israel, to leave Russia. So my mother's brother, who I only met then later when we went to the West, he left immediately to Israel because his wife was a Polish Jewess. To say that it was a liberal Jewish family is saying too little, because my parents belonged to a Zionist group, a clandestine group in Riga, who it was led by Josef Kuskovsky. And this group was clandestine. It was of traditional Jews, not religious Jews, not specifically studying Torah, but studying the language, Hebrew, and thinking when they would be allowed to leave the Soviet Union. And this is how I grew up, with such people surrounding me. What happened in the end, maybe you recall there was attempted hijack in St. Petersburg, when a group of mostly Jewish people, Silva Zalmonson and Kuznetsov Anatoly and Mendeleevich, there were 11 of them. So my parents spoke Yiddish at home, not German, but Yiddish. And they thought that I don't understand it because I never talked back to them. I answered them in Russian, especially my father. He spoke Russian with a very strong Baltic German accent. Anyhow, my parents spoke about this hijack at home because we're second line organizers of this group. And from what I understand, I was really little at that time. Phone calls were coming in from the United States or from abroad. And every day the phone calls came to a different phone number. This was in an attempt to make it a little bit more difficult for KGB to find out what's going on. So I remember when, with my father, we went to the central telephone station. This is how it was done those days. And we ordered, we paid, I think, 6 or 7 rubles, which is a lot of money at that time. And in order to speak some number abroad for 5 minutes. Then I remember my parents tell each other in Yiddish that it will not work out, that the KGB found about it, that the people will be, the hijackers will be arrested when they climbed the first steps of the airplane. And this is, in fact, what happened.
We have an episode that covers this hijacking attempt. It's episode 258. There'll be a link in the episode information.
I was a little girl. I was 12 by then. I was a little girl. And I got so offended by it, by the fact that people were not allowed to go. I decided to do something. There was some kind of poem from a French poet who was a communist, but he wrote a poem, something like, "Let my people go." Let's summarize, like, "Let my people go." So there were no Xerox machines at that time. It was 1971. So I wrote this poem by hand 20 times or 15 times. I gave it to every Jewish classmate in my school. At the same time, I was, it's interesting, my mother, although it's not common, but my mother insisted that I train, you know, figure skating, which is quite a hard sport. It's not common for quiet girls from a Jewish family, maybe languages and piano, which I also did. But in fact, English and figure skating was... it was a clandestine plan of my mother that if I am good and if I go to international competitions, that I will stay abroad, like I will not return to the Soviet Union. I was training in the national team, and after school, I went to train, and I came back very late. Maybe it was late 9 o'clock in the evening, because. We practiced 4 or 5 hours a day at the skating rink. So I come home and I see a black car, like a big, we called it Voronok, a black Pobeda, which was driven normally by high officials, party officials. But the black ones were for the KGB. So can you imagine, a 12-year-old girl, I come back from training and I see this car in front of our house, and I remember what I did during the day at school. But what should I, you know, I decided, what can I do? I decided to go home, to go upstairs. And to my surprise, the person who came to visit us was the father of my classmate, a Russian girl. He was vice deputy of the ministry who allowed people to go abroad and emigration. So he's talking to my parents and he's saying, my name is, you know, my born name is Yeta. So he says, this girl is going to my parents, this girl is going to be in prison because she is juvenile and you are responsible for her. And if she continues like this, and she's a champion in figure skating. So he says to my parents, please get an invitation to go to Israel as soon as possible and I will let you go. This was in February 1971, and in June we left. It all went very quickly. My my mother's other brother, she had three all in all. He lived in London since late 40s, so under a different name. But he, after Stalin's death, he reached us by writing. You know, he wrote us, my mother, a letter, and his brother, he wrote the family a letter from London. So officially, he was a different surname, but it was my mother's brother. And he arranged very quickly. He came to Moscow under his clandestine, under his new identity, and which was a risk for him. I remember this meeting. I remember going to Moscow to see him. And he arranged for an invitation to go to Israel, and we were able to leave within 4 months.
Were some of your other Jewish friends at school able to emigrate at this time?
And everybody was talking about the possibility of leaving Latvia. And in my class, there were maybe out of 30, 18 Jewish students. And today there is one of them, just one of them, who stayed behind. Within a year, the class was dismantled because already when we were the first ones to go, but we were like saying, see you soon. Of course, nobody was sure of that. And it took some people, you know, longer to leave. But the feeling was that we will never come back to Latvia, but the feeling was that we will see each other again.
How did you leave the Soviet Union?
At that time, you know, the only possibility was to leave Russia by train, to go via Minsk to Vienna. And in Vienna, the Jewish families were not allowed to carry any money on them, even not a passport. There was some kind of pink paper, like smaller than an A4, folded with a photograph and the name scribbled on it with a stamp, allowed to leave the Soviet Union for permanent residency abroad. So it was not even a passport. I remember that people were afraid what will happen. Will somebody meet us in Vienna? Because pro person, grown up, they were allowed to take $100 with them. So $200 in the pocket. I was a teenager, so nothing for me. And all the families coming to Vienna, and not just mine, just ours, maybe 10 families from Riga. And the journey took us a bit over 24 hours. So anyhow, we arrive in Vienna and we get off the train thinking, who will be there to meet us? You know, the famous Sochnut, the agency, the Jewish agency for Israel people, Sochnut, they were there. They were there standing on the platform, waving. And they took us, at those times, they took us to a castle which they rented. It was called Schönbrunn. And this is where we got to stay in the first days. And then the families or the people were asked whether they wanted to go to Israel or to the United States, where many families had their relatives.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
So we were not sure, but the next day, my mother's brother, Simon, from London, arrived in Vienna, and by taxi, he took us from Sokhnut, he took us over. He took us to a hotel in central Vienna, opposite the famous cathedral, St. Stephan's Cathedral. I can remember it was opposite a big, like in every European city, I guess, a big shopping mall across this square. And my mother was very worried that I will go into the shopping mall and will be stunned by the riches, by the lavishness. But it was like I walked into that. I remember I walked into that shopping mall like I belonged there. I was not surprised. It was like I was born into it. And it was more my mother that was surprised. And like she wanted to treat my uncle to something. He loved home cooking, but she couldn't cook. But we brought some herring, some special herring with us from Riga, pickled herring. And she decided to do some toast with herring. But in the hotel room, there was no fridge. So she opened the window. And she put the sandwiches covered. So can you imagine when my uncle arrives and she wants to treat him, she opens the window and St. Stephan's Square, it's where all the pigeons, like in Venice, like millions of pigeons. So nothing, they, you know, it was everything, the treat was gone. These are my first impressions of the West. Anyhow, my uncle was a champion. I don't know how he managed, but within 3 or 4 days, he managed to get a permission, a visa, like an entrance visa, for us. Using these folded pieces of paper that we had, not even a passport. He managed to get them stamped in the British Embassy for us to go to fly with him to London.
And what were your first impressions of London compared to the Soviet Union?
We lived the other side of Baker Street, Portman Mansions on the street. But anyhow, behind the Sherlock Holmes Museum, can you imagine? It's the best location, one of the best locations in London. My uncle's apartment there was small. My parents got a little bit, not surprised, but disappointed, because they thought that he's a rich man, which he was, and living in such a small one-bedroom apartment in a very posh place, but small. As a kid, I was not intimidated by it. I liked it. My uncle was really preparing himself for us to come. He purchased a house in northwest London, not quite Golders Green, but not far away from there. And this was meant to be for my family. It was when we arrived, it was being renovated. So we went to look at it, and my parents felt better. So in fact, my uncle was prepared to stay in the small apartment, like what my mother thought, but he would give us a house. She didn't understand this psychology. I remember my first weeks walking to Selfridges and walking to Piccadilly. I could speak English. I don't know, I didn't feel like I came to this other capitalist world. I felt like I fell into place immediately.
I think you're 12 at this point. So what do you do in London? Are you allowed to wander about on your own?
I was allowed to walk on my own, but it wasn't for too long, because my mother and my mother didn't get along with her brother. And about 2 months later, late August, my father decided that he will take the family to Israel. So there wasn't really time for me to go to school. Because it was in the summer. And in August 71, we left London and we went to Israel. And this is where I continued my studies. It was very fast. I have a nightmare still, because I always skipped. I guess my education in Riga, in this very elite school, in Latvia, I guess the education was very good, because I was just skipping classes. So I very shortly, in a year, I found myself in Israel, almost reaching like what you would call in England A levels, my matriculation exams. In the meantime, I stayed in Israel less than 2 years. And in those 2 years, I traveled twice back to London. My uncle felt that he could do maybe more for me than my emigrant parents. So I traveled twice to London. And in 1973, in October, my father died dramatically, and I couldn't forgive my mother his death, so I ran away from home in Israel. And this is when my uncle finally decided to bring me back to London. So I guess, yes, it was again sometimes like in the spring of 1974, I was back to London for good. I just turned 16, which is too early to go to university, but I matriculated in, I did my A levels in Israel. So I could study. I could go to university because I had my exams, but I was too young to be accepted. I stayed with my uncle and I worked for his company for a while, and then I decided to do something on my own. I was an au pair for a short time. Like I was not an easy child. So I was an au pair, and one day I walked down in Aldwych down the Strand, and I saw this house, Bush House. Bush House that I remember, because when I was still in Riga in Latvia, my father would make me listen to the BBC in Russian, to the Russian service, and they always announced after or during the program, you're listening to BBC Russian service. The announcer would say, we are broadcasting to you from Bush House, London. So I went to visit the Russian service, of course. I remember the name of one commentator, which was Anatoly Maximovich Goldberg. And he was previously working for, not for the Russian service, but for the international, I think there is...
The BBC World Service.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. So he was a very known and a very respectable commentator. And I was quite cheeky to say that I want to see Anatoly Maximovich. But I guess he was so surprised that somebody's, a young girl, is asking for him. So out of curiosity, he went to see me. And I remember he said, he asked me, can you type in Russian? And I said, no, I can't, because I can only, like, I'm very proficient with English typewriter, but I will learn fast the layout And he said, okay, come back tomorrow and we will test you. And in the morning I came back, and during the night I borrowed out somewhere Russian typewriter with a Russian keyboard. And when I came back, I said to the person who was examining me that I can't type fast yet, because I only had one night to learn, but the speed will come very quickly. I was not, you know, I was a little bit unconfident, because I expected a little bit something like harder. The exam would be harder. So I was making excuses for myself. And after I was done with typing, my grammar was good in Russian, you know, my Russian grammar. I was 16, also too young to work, but they said, you come back. I remember the name of them, Mrs. Coleman. So she said, please come back in 2 weeks. This is how long it will take us to process your papers with the Home Office to get a work permit. So I think that was it. That was my destiny, because I still didn't have proper documents. I didn't return back to Israel, so my documents also were not extended. So I guess this was my destiny, because only such a strong company like BBC could legalize, let's put it that way, get my papers straight, with work permit and everything. So I came back 2 weeks later, and I was the youngest, I guess, in the Russian service. I was the youngest employee among all these new immigrants, mostly already new immigrants from the Soviet Union. All radio stations like Voice of America and Radio Liberty and BBC were trying to hire newcomers from the Soviet Union, because the old guard, the old emigration, they were very, getting old. Their Russian was not good anymore, not up, you know, like it was the Tsarist language. And they needed fresh blood. There were some extraordinary persons there from the first emigration. So people with highly cultured people with very, let's say, aristocratic biographies. So on the one hand, but they were getting less and less. And 80% were already newcomers from the Soviet Union, the immigrants. They were all against the Soviet Union, very liberal, very dissident, mostly dissident. And this is how I guess, had it not been BBC, I would have integrated completely into the London life, and I probably would have forgotten Russian by now. But I guess, again, it's destined for me not to. I don't know which one would be better for me today. I was young. I could have become fully integrated. But there you are. And I ended as the youngest employee in the Russian service of the BBC.
Did you ever meet Georgi Markov, the BBC Bulgarian journalist who was assassinated by what's thought to be the Bulgarian secret services in London?
Of course. The Bulgarian section was on the same floor. Just we occupied maybe 10 offices, like 10 rooms, and the Bulgarian section was the next. So it was only obvious that we would meet each other during work. But it was also very common for us to go down to canteen, to the big BBC canteen, and the day Markov was stabbed by poison, by umbrella. I remember it was Natasha Ray. She ran away in Algeria. She didn't return. She was a Russian, not an emigree, but a defector, a Russian defector. So it was her, Markov, and me. We were having a cup of tea, and I can still remember how he said, Georgi said, I feel I'm getting fever and I'm getting weak. I don't feel well. I'll go home.
Wow. So you were with Georgi Markov the same day that he was poisoned?
Yes. He didn't mention anything about it. He just said that he doesn't feel well, and the next day he was in the hospital. But they couldn't save him.
What was he like? Was he quite fun to be with?
He was absolutely an outspoken, very polite, a real, like, we from the Soviet Union, we were still more like Russian, under Russian culture. But he was very European, very polite, very kind. I never saw him being distressed or not agreeable. I mean, he was a very polite, nice person.
I lived in London at the time that Markov was assassinated, and I clearly remember all the press intrigue about this story and the fact that somebody appeared to have jabbed him with a poisoned umbrella on Waterloo Bridge at a bus stop.
It was a shock. It was a shock. Of course, it was a shock to all of us at the radio, because we felt, of course, he was preparing a series of programs about the Bulgarian leader, party leader. But we all did some kind of Solzhenitsyn programs on Solzhenitsyn, of, you know, forbidden stuff. We were distressed.
Now, around this time, you meet Oleg, who has a massive impact on your life.
Oleg had a friend in London, a defector like himself, and a very simple man, a carpenter. But still, he was a Russian and he was fun. And Oleg used to come to London once every 2 years because he shopped at Harrods. He exchanged his wardrobe every 2 years. And also he liked to collect stamps. He was a philatelist. So he came to London. It was his routine trip to London. And also, you know, he liked the Playboy Club. So he came to London and he stayed with Vladik. And Vlad was trying to arrange some kind of company for the evening. I basically rejected. Vlad was maybe around 40. Oleg was 34. So I basically rejected men of this age. They were too old for me. So I rejected the invitation for the evening. But they were adamant. In the evening, I already had my own studio flat in Judd Street, and they knew the address. I think Vlad did some carpenter work for me before, so they knew the address, and they knocked at my door. So I opened the door, and then I couldn't escape them. Vlad came with Oleg, and he said, "Get dressed, we're going out." So we went to Playboy.
What were your first impressions of Oleg?
He was like a typical Slav, not too tall, but very broad shoulders. And I saw his shoulders from the back when we were getting into Vlad's car. And I felt protected behind those shoulders. A young girl without her parents and being on her own in London, I felt, when I saw him from the back, I felt protected. He was very, very quiet person. He didn't speak much. He gave the impression of a very confident person. So all in all, I liked him.
I've read one of your descriptions of him. Is he looked like a Russian Alain Delon?
Absolutely. Everybody, the girls were behind him. It was terrible. Everybody wanted, you know, we were not too many Russians, or Russian-speaking, let's put it that way, a better explanation, not too many Russian-speaking persons in Europe at that time, maybe all in all, maybe 500. So, and that's maybe even too much. But if somebody wanted to date a common, like from the Soviet Union. There wasn't too much choice. The girls were behind him, girls that were older than me and more experienced. And I guess this is what turned Oleg off from these women. He was not in a rush. He wasn't. He was not just like a Russian teddy bear, they also called him, but he was making girls run crazy. And I knew once we already learned each other, and I asked, asked the people around. I was doing a little bit of my research. Well, I understood that I really shouldn't talk to too many people about learning him. It was like before it happens, like before we marry, I shouldn't tell anybody. Just I should keep it secret. Because in fact, we married in Campden Hall 2 weeks later. It took us only a fortnight.
Wow.
To get it was like, yeah.
That's incredible.
He was in a rush. That's incredible.
Just a bit of background on Oleg. How did he escape from the Soviet Union and end up at Radio Liberty?
From what I knew and from what everybody knew at that time was that he was this brave salesman on a military ship with his family having a very strong communist and army background. So an officer's son who served on a Russian military ship who escaped in the, how do you say in English, Dar es Salaam. It's the United something waters of, anyhow, Dar es Salaam. It's the coast of Egypt. They were in the neutral waters opposite the Egyptian shore, according to what we know. And he was, because he was privileged on the ship, like he explains, coming from such a family, he was responsible for monitoring the anti-rocket missiles. And to do that, he had he was given the geographical location map, so he knew exactly how far Libya was away, you know, the border to Libya, so he could plan his escape in the neutral waters, but opposite Egyptian coast, which he first reached after he swam several miles in the water at night, you know, in the dark. And at dawn, he crossed the border to Libya. He knew the direction because he had those maps previously. He crossed the border to Libya, and there, with the help of Bedouins, he spent several days before they actually showed him the way to the British camp. He was picked up by the Brits in the beginning in Libya, and he stayed with the British army in the first days of his questioning. And then, from what I understand, he's talking quite fondly of the British colonel. In his book, he's talking quite fondly of the British colonel. Oleg he was not dressed properly. So before the Brits turned Oleg over to the American, he got clothing from the British colonel. You know, he talks quite fondly of the British, but the reason why he couldn't stay in Britain is because I think at that time the British Prime Minister was planning a trip to the Soviet Union. And so it was kind of a risk, a bigger risk to accept a defector from the Soviet Union. So it was the British intelligence suggested to Oleg that if he didn't mind, they would turn him over to the Americans, who didn't mind having a rift with the Russians because they were enemies anyhow, Soviet Union and the USA.
How did he end up at Radio Liberty?
So the Americans took him by military plane to Frankfurt, where he was examined for 6 months and interrogated to make sure that he was a real defector. And he describes these 6 months very extensively in his book. And after he passed all the exams and the Americans were confident about him, they started looking for a job for him. And it was just the time when Radio Liberty in Munich was looking also like the BBC for new personnel. So it was the American intelligence at Frankfurt, American intelligence officers, who actually gave him this employment at the radio. So basically he was their man at the radio from the beginning. Most of the American bosses or American personnel at the radio were former military anyhow. So, and Oleg was between the first ones who joined Radio Liberty before other emigrants were recruited, but they never had the same rank because they were just emigrants, and Oleg passed the examinations at the American military intelligence, you know, with the military intelligence. So obviously he was a different rank, which many employees of the radio later couldn't understand. He didn't have an American citizenship. That's why officially he was not employed by the American intelligence. But this was the only difficulty.
And what role was he doing when he met you?
When we met, he was already chief of the news, of the Russian news. But Americans liked stable people with families and children. So when we married, it gave him kind of a push. And very soon he was offered the job of the senior editor of the Russian service, which was the highest rank that a non-American could reach or could be at the radio in the Russian service.
And what's the difference between Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe?
These are two different, in one building, but two different activities. Radio Free Europe was broadcasting to the European countries of the Soviet bloc, or Radio Liberty was broadcasting in all languages of the Soviet Union. I mean, Russian, including all republics, Georgian, Ukrainian, to all the republics.
Oleg is based in Germany. So you have to move to Germany with him?
It was our choice. We could have stayed in London. It was our choice because I felt after we married, I felt that I want to change. But I was playing into Oleg's gate because he needed me for what happened later. He needed me to be completely dependent on him. So basically, when I said that I would prefer him not to take over the job at Radio Liberty London office, but rather I would give up everything and join him in Munich, it suited him. I quitted my job at the BBC. I sold my studio in Judd Street, or rather I gave a power of attorney to sell it. It was sold shortly after I already moved to Munich. And the money was transferred to me then from London. But the biggest mistake was, or the biggest thing was that I was entitled to a British passport in a year if I stayed in England. This was making me a little bit sad, unhappy. So Oleg said, don't worry, I will arrange for you to have a German passport or an American, whatever you prefer. This shouldn't be a problem. So basically, I made myself completely dependent on him.
How did he tell you that he was working for the KGB? Can you describe the moment? Don't miss next week's episode where we hear more about Svetlana's life as the wife of a KGB spy. Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.